generator. In fact, if you go one step further and you set, you substitute that resistor that charges the capacitor, you substitute it with a network that has a constant current output, now the circuit is capable of making a very linear, high-fidelity, sawtooth waveform. And nowadays you can buy integrated circuit chips that do put out a constant current, or by using an operational amplifier with the right kind of a feedback, you could make an extremely linear RC network, a sawtooth generator. And one step further than that, you could make a triangle wave generator. When you go to the Burr-Brown third generation handbook on operational amplifiers, this is an oldie. It was a handbook written in the late 60s, but I guarantee it's still available. And you go to the section on operational amplifiers used in oscillator network. Boy, you've got some very fancy networks in there with very inexpensive modern-day operational amplifiers, 30 cents a piece, so to speak. And the
4 with the tube you're talking about.
What was the tube that we're talking about, Hal? Go ahead.
884, the gas cell. Try it as far as the grid you sink it. That was your tube.
Okay, so you can get some real nice performance in the old days out of the 884 tube. There's enough friends on there. So with operational amplifiers, that's nowadays you give a whole lot of transistors in one tiny little package in the bubble packs at Radio Shack. And with the right kind of feedback networks with those operational amplifiers, you can make nearly perfect square wave generators, triangle wave generators, sawtooth generators, sine wave generators, and cosine wave generators simultaneously, absolute value rectifier circuits, and so on. So when it comes to oscillators, which are a real fun subject, the right kind of a handbook teaching you how to build various kinds of oscillators and a handful of FET transistors, bipolar transistors, or operational amplifiers, and that Burr-Brown third-generation operational handbook techniques, operational techniques of handbooks, you know what I mean. That Burr-Brown book is a real goodie. As I said, it was published in the late 60s, and if you get a used copy of it, I think it's worth having. It's got sections on how to make logarithmic amplifiers, how to make fancy kinds of oscillators, how to make circuits that have nearly an input-input impedance as an amplifier, and so on. Lots of very good circuits in there. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And don't forget the Dynatron oscillator, Dick.
Fantastron, Dynatron. You'd be amazed on some of these crazy kinds of oscillators that made sawtooth and other kinds of pulsed waveforms as repetitive oscillators. In the old days, there were lots of these things. Over to you, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, that was a well-used circuit, and you're right about the oscilloscope. The old RCA 3-inch was that way. And worked pretty well. Recurrent sweep, but it worked. Let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one. Okay, this one's going to have two or three parts to it. This is a question on RF propagation. If we have two signal generators producing basically 5 watts each at 10 megahertz, 180 degrees out of phase, and coupled to an antenna, assuming you will have zero output RF at the antenna. Is that correct?
Depending on how we set that up, I think the answer is yes. If he has equal length of cable on each signal generator, if the signal generators are synchronized to each other, they've got a common reference oscillator, so that they really stay 180 degrees out of phase, and each one is at the exact same amount of power, two separate feed lines going into a power summing network, which could in some cases be nothing more than a T-connector, but a real power summing network, and then the common port goes to the antenna. Yes, you're getting an in-phase signal from one gen, an out-of-signal phase from the other gen, and the antenna will say, I don't see anything, there's nothing to transmit. Well, there's a bunch of catches here. Are the two signal generators exactly 180 degrees out of phase? If one of them is a little bit leading or lagging compared to the other, the antenna will see some signal. are the two signals at the antenna exactly equal in amplitude. One's always going to be a little stronger than the other. Furthermore, now you have to obey conservation of energy. Each signal generator in his example is producing 10 watts of power. A total of 20 watts is being delivered to the power summing device after the two cables right at the antenna. Where's that 20 watts going? In the real world, if it was an impedance-matched power divider slash summing device at the antenna, let me drop. A thoroughly impedance-matched device at that location looks at the difference in power between the two input ports that appears across the dummy load that gives you the isolation between the two ports. A good power summing device has isolation. The isolation is coming from internal balance and the presence of a dummy load between the two ports. If it's a Wilkinson hybrid type device, there's a high power 100 ohm resistor between the two ports. It would be absorbing the 20 watts. If you really did it the quick and dirty way that many an amateur would do, where a simple T connector is located at the antenna, and the T connector common port goes to the antenna, and the other two ports go to the signal generators, what really happens is the signal from signal generator number one flows to the T connector, input port, flows out the other input port of the T connector, and goes down towards signal generator number two. And the same thing with signal generator number two signal. It's appearing at signal generator number one. If the signal generators really were high power signal generators, high quality with 50 ohms, the excess power of signal generator number one would be absorbed in the output signal, output circuitry, the 50 ohm circuit, of signal generator number two, and vice versa. The hard thing to believe in that situation is the power would be absorbed by the opposite signal generator. Let me drop. However, when you start getting up to 10 watt level of signal generators, which means it's got a real output amplifier, and the real output amplifier, if it was a balanced amplifier, it would be a 50 ohm load, and it would absorb the signal coming back into its back end. But many a single-ended amplifier really is a constant current generator. It has an input, has an output impedance, an S22, which you'd measure on a network analyzer. It's a very high number of ohms. It's almost an open circuit, a constant current generator. Therefore, of the 10 watts from signal generator number one that arrives at signal generator number two, essentially all of it would be reflected in my second example. So now you get power bouncing back and forth between these two cables. You actually do this experiment depending on the quality of the signal generator, the type of amplifier in the output stage of the signal generator, depending on the nature of the power summing device at the antenna, depending on the local amount of balancing of amplitudes and phases. As you can see, you can get quite a large number of results on this simple sounding example. So it would be a beautiful study. In fact, one of the puzzles that was in QTC, the amateur exchange, the technical exchange of ARRL, this exact puzzle was given about 4 years ago, and I was the guy that answered the puzzle in the back end of that book. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the breakdown.
Okay, Dick, not that it makes much difference. 5 watts at 10 megahertz. 5 watts is still a lot out of a generator. Okay, so we're going to assume that everything you said is true, that we have a good match, same length cables, so now we effectively had zero emanation from that antenna. Okay, now what he's asking is, if he had a receiver located some distance from there with perfect propagation, detects no signal. Now, if he lowered one signal generator by 6 dB, would he now notice a 6 dB signal at the receiver?
Okay. Mother Nature does not add power per se. She adds voltages. Each signal generator is producing some number of volts when they're running full power. When I go down to 6 dB, decrease on one of the signal generators, I am halving the voltage of the signal generator. Therefore, the first signal generator is still running full voltage, second signal generator running half voltage. half the voltage is now being canceled, the other half is not, and therefore, would the signal coming out of the antenna change by 6 dB? Absolutely not. If you had perfect phase match and perfect amplitude match, the signal coming out of the antenna was nothing. If I had only one signal generator turned on, and I measured the amount of power, and now I start playing with these ratios of the second signal generator, yes, I can make a 6 dB change in the output. But if I go to from nothing to half voltage of his example, nothing really is in decibels minus infinity, and now he's got half voltage, he's got some amount of power. Let me give it a number, plus 30 dBm if it was 1 watt. When I go from minus infinity to plus 30 dBm, that's an infinite number of decibels change. So we've got a little bit of a problem of definition. If the signal was really perfectly canceled, at minus infinity in dB coming out of the antenna, I think you see some of the problem of definition here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, in the tech band.
UA1PVH.
VBH recognized. We're going to get to you in a second. First, go, John, go ahead.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, that basically answers his first question. Now, the second part is that the same setup, if he were to change the phase of one generator by 90 degrees, what would be the expected result of the antenna?
That's the so-called quadrature case. You go from perfect cancellation, when everything is exactly 180 degrees out of phase and exactly equal in amplitude, and now you go quadrature, two signals added at 90 degrees to each other give you a resultant output signal. It's really like a 1-1 square root of 2, 90 degree right triangle. That's what you're really doing. You can make a vector diagram which is a equilateral 90 degree right triangle. Each leg is, in my example, 1 volt. The hypotenuse is what you're transmitting. It would be a square root of 2 of the 1 volt, you know, square root of the sum of the squares type stuff. So you would be 3 decibels louder than any one signal generator when there is 90 degrees of phase shift. Ain't that crazy? If you turned on one signal generator and measured the radiated signal, turn on the second signal generator 90 degrees away, the signal will be 3 decibels louder when the two signal generators are running versus one. You're adding two things at right angles, and when you do that, when you add two vectors at right angles to each other, the resultant vector is 21% bigger in voltage, 41%. Square root of 2 is 1.41, 41% bigger, which is a 3 dB increase. Ain't that crazy? 3 dB increase compared to perfect cancellation, that's an infinite number of dB of change. Compared to one signal generator, it's a 3 dB increase when you turn on the second signal generator 90 degrees away. So you're adding voltage vectors. And as I said before, when it comes to adding things together in various antennas with phased arrays and whatever, add voltages. Mother Nature adds and subtracts voltages.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Mother Nature adds voltages considering the phase angle. That's what makes them into vector voltages. Now, Harold up there in the New Hampshire-Massachusetts border, looks like we got some good propagation tonight. He's given me this idea of feeding power up the hardline cable to run my 10-gig equipment with a full-wave rectifier up top. Whether I put positive voltage or negative voltage, the regulator will always get the same voltage, and the regulator will be running all the electronics. But positive voltage versus negative voltage will tail the electronics to either go to the transmit mode or the receive mode. So the 12 megacycle or the 10 megacycle receiver you put up there and the other signal to do the controlling, there was a possibly slightly simpler way yet, Harold. WA1VVH, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, WA1PPH, you're sort of flat, but I've been listening.
Yeah, I was a little bit afraid of that. We're going to run into Murphy's Law here. In other words, when the signal is coming from a place 300 miles away or whatever that distance is up there to Harold on the
way, and as you mentioned earlier, some of the ways besides.
And there are several other ways of doing it. You're absolutely right, Harold. When you got a signal that's propagating over something like 300 miles, let's see, the distance between Harold and me, I can find out by going to QIZ.com, and the distance is 156 miles. So the 156 miles between me and him, you're going to be getting long phase periods. And so he could have been hearing us nice and loud. We go back and talk to him, and then Mother Nature gives you a phase just at the time you want to hear from him. That's what happens with long-range VHF sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't happen that way. But there's lots of ways of sending power up the cable. And the nice thing about sending the power up the semiconductor of the cable, not only do you not have to send a separate line for doing commanding and powering, you don't have to send a multi-conductor cable, but now everything is perfectly shielded. When lightning comes along, you don't get any impulse, EM, electromagnetic pulse being coupled into your wiring, because it's all inside of the coax cable. So it's a rather safe way to go and a nice, simple way to go. Only there's one cable that you got to run up the tower, so to speak. Now, if I know you, John, if I know this guy, one test was to change the amplitude, one test was to change the phase, and there's various ways of changing the phase. And so is 90 degrees the only way of doing it? No. Once you are able to modulate the phase of the second signal generator versus the first signal generator, once you're summing the signals together with the right kind of a power summing device that has built-in isolation, like a Wilkinson hybrid, you now have the ability to modulate a kilowatt transmitter using milliwatts of audio, so to speak, just shifting the phase of one signal generator versus the other. A variable capacitance diode on the oscillator circuit could be shifting the phase and therefore modulating the output in a very controlled manner. There's a whole There's a whole series of very sophisticated circuits. I can't think of the name of them right now. It's got a fancy name. It's the proper name of the guy who invented the technique. But by vector summing technique, you can very nicely control the resultant amplitude with high fidelity of what comes out of those two signal generators. To really build an amplitude modulator with high linearity could be very difficult. To use the right kind of a computer-generated network to shift the phase of one signal versus the other can give you extremely controlled output amplitude and phase in a way that's got extremely high linearity and very low intermodulation distortion if you do it correctly. So he may or may not know that he's onto a very sophisticated kind of circuit here as he follows through on this one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, very well. I have no idea what he's trying to do, but some of the experiments that he has here are very interesting. His next point is, what happens now, same conditions, same receiver, if he varies the frequency of one by, say, 1,000 cycles, going to have a tone, what is going to be heard by the receiver? And what is going to happen to the RF level at the antenna? Back to you, Dick.
Don, good question. And this is exactly what happens with a FM receiver that's getting co-channel interference. If my broadcast receiver between 88 and 108 megacycles is listening to QXR 93.1 from New Jersey, and if there happens to be another 93.1 coming in from Chicago at the same time, although those two signals are, by FCC standards, within 10 hertz of each other, almost on the exact same frequency, but they're both FM modulating their signals. And therefore, the audio that's doing the FM modulating from Chicago and the audio that's doing the FM modulating from New Jersey are absolutely uncorrelated with each other. So periodically, the two signals are separated instantaneously by many kilohertz. So you have, each signal is being plus or minus 75 kilohertz FM modulated, and the two are uncorrelated. So there are times when the two signals are 150 kilohertz apart, and there are times when they're 0 kilohertz apart. It's happening very dynamically. If he did it in his particular case, where he's got two synthesized signal generators, and he sets one frequency, 1 kilohertz higher than the other. You've now got to go step by step to see what's going to happen when you drop. During the instant of time that one signal is higher in frequency than the other, you could represent it as a vector diagram where one vector sits still because you're using it as a stroboscope, so to speak. One vector is sitting up at 12 o'clock. The other vector is like the large hand of a clock, and it rotates from 12 o'clock toward 1 o'clock, toward 3 o'clock, toward 6 o'clock. It's moving in a clockwise manner. That's the one that's 1 kilohertz higher, and he completes one complete cycle every millisecond. That's what 1 kilohertz higher means. So the second vector is being added to the first vector. The first vector in this simplistic diagram is sitting still, sitting at 12 o'clock, and the second vector is rotating once every millisecond. It goes all the way around the clock. During the instant of time that the two vectors are at both at 12 o'clock, I'm getting twice voltage. I'm getting a 6 decibel increase compared to only one signal generator being turned on. During the time that the second vector is at 3 o'clock, I'm only getting a 3 dB increase. During the time that the second vector is at 6 o'clock, I'm getting perfect cancellation. They're 180 degrees out of phase. I'm getting infinite decibels of suppression. So what you're going to hear when you listen to that signal is you're going to hear 1 kilohertz of amplitude modulation. That's the good news. It is not a sine wave because the complete amplitude goes from twice voltage down to zero voltage in a nonlinear manner. It's not like amplitude modulation. The way it goes through zero is an extremely sharp null. The resultant signal looks like double sideband suppressed carrier modulation. It's got a very raspy tone to it. There will be a dominant 1 kilohertz signal. Let me drop. There'll be a dominant 1 kilohertz signal, but you'll also be hearing many harmonics of 1 kilohertz because of the sharp cutoff characteristic as the second vector walks through the 6 o'clock position. This whole concept is pretty well calculated and described mathematically in the Baghdadi book. Baghdadi, 1950, McGraw-Hill, Lectures on Communication System Theory is the name of the book. And you go to the section on an ideal FM discriminator limiter circuit where co-channel interference is happening. Depending on the quality of the limiter and the number of stages of limiting, you eventually have what's called capture effect or suppression. If the second vector is a little bit weaker than the first vector, when it gets down to the 6 o'clock position, you don't get full cancellation. If your limiter has enough quality to it and enough stages of gain in front of it, it could happen in such a way that the cutoff of signal at the 6 o'clock position does not happen. You get a little bit of phase modulation of the resultant signal, but what you hear is the strong signal all the time. The weak signal is having a minor phase shifting effect on the stronger signal. It's called the capture effect. And with FM modulation, if the FM discriminator and limiter has high enough quality, let me drop, you get 6 decibels of suppression on each stage of limiting when everything is working correctly. So as long as there is a little bit of difference in amplitude between the two signals, a properly designed limiter discriminator network will completely suppress the weaker signal by something like 20 or 30 decibels. If you listen carefully, you'll hear the weaker signal, but it will be heavily suppressed. The NEMS Clark Company in Washington, D.C. area, way back in the middle 60s, manufactured what they called an extremely high capture ratio receiver by very careful design of the discriminator and limiters that were in front of it on this FM receiver. They had what they called 0.997 capture ratio. In other words, if the weaker signal in voltage was 0.3% weaker than the stronger signal going into that receiver, the weaker signal would be suppressed by 20 decibels. The real difference in amplitude going into the receiver between the two signals is 0.05 dB, so to speak. But after the network does its thing with those two signals. The weaker signal is suppressed by 20 decibels when the difference is a small fraction of 1 decibel going in. So there's a whole art in science to what happens to dual signals when one is slightly different in phase or frequency compared to the other. And that's a whole beautiful area of study, and a person who has that knowledge can sometimes write a check for a company that needs that knowledge that's doing that kind of work, if you know what I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick, KC2WGB. Great subject. Very interesting. I wish I knew what he was doing. Maybe I'll email him and try to find out. But he's got an adventure going there. Well, that's about it from Mel's Corner. And we can go on. Maybe pick up Paul and see what the space report is. KC2WGB.
Yeah, even if the two signals are getting closer and closer to amplitude, as the weaker signal, the vector, walks past the 12 o'clock position in that vector diagram, you get an instantaneous click out of the receiver, out of the FM receiver. And there's something called the click analysis. So you get these series of clicks, but you get very little real audio out of the weaker signal if the receiver is properly designed. Now, this is what happens with wideband FM. This is what happens with broadcast type FM, plus or minus 75 kilohertz. There's a whole series of advantages you get out of that kind of a receiver, and you get some extremely high fidelity when they're well designed. That's the good news. The bad news is that each of those FM channels on FM broadcast are 200 kilohertz separated. You can only squeeze 5 of them in there per megacycle. And nowadays with the FM two-way channel communication that's used for fire and police and ambulance and whatever, the FCC is going out there busily and dividing those channels smaller and smaller. They used to be 15 kilohertz channels, they're now going to be 20 kilohertz spacing, and now going to go down to something like 12 kilohertz spacing. Somebody naively thinks if they make each of the channels more narrow of FM two-way communication for all of these first responders, they think that they can squeeze more signals in there and that they're going to get a benefit. When you start studying what really happens under real communication conditions, when you start making the signal more and more narrow, you pick up a huge number of disadvantages. If they properly studied the network, it is my strong belief the FCC would not have set these rules to make the channels more narrow. The number of disadvantages they're going to get. The number of disadvantages they're going to get, the number of co-channel interference problems they're going to get, the number of intermodulation distortion problems they're going to get, the number of lack of communication circuits. In other words, your threshold of audio, the quality of the audio, goes down considerably when you start making the modulation more and more narrow, less than the modulation index of unity. Delta F over F sub M is called modulation index. On paper, it looks great to make the signal more narrow. You actually do that with FM. You pick up a huge number of disadvantages. The only advantage they're going to get out of this, and the reason why many companies were pushing for it, is that they're going to sell brand new equipment. Everything's going to have to be upgraded. That's the good news. A lot of money is going to flow for buying new equipment. The real performance in the real world is probably going to be more detriment than advantage.
Dick, does that apply to digital also?
When it comes to digital first responder networks, boy, there are horror stories out there. Again, on paper, it sounds great. But there are lots and lots of stories of a fireman being in the basement of a building. He flips over to the local communication mode on his digital two-way handy-talkie in his hand, and he starts hollering, "Mayday." And the people 200 yards outside of the building away from him, almost within line of sight, are not hearing what he's saying. The number of problems they're running into with these 800 megacycle trunked digital type systems is so huge that anybody who simply goes out and writes a check and buys a system like that without really studying it end to end, cost of ownership, real reliability, track record and whatever, if they naively make that purchase, boy, are they going to be unhappy. So there's a there's a hell of a lot more bad news than there is good news with these systems. On top of that, you think you're going to get security because of the digital. That's a very mixed blessing. In the case of many emergency systems, when you have other people with their scanners listening to what's going on, you at least have another set of ears that can play it back to you later on and tell you what happened. When you make everything as exclusive as you think you are going to, and nobody gets the message anymore, has that security bought you anything? I doubt it. There's a hell of a lot of purchasing of circuits these days for first responders that are very naive purchases, done by people who know how to write a check, but they don't know how to analyze the radio circuits that they're buying. And in many cases, what they're buying is really giving them a lot of trouble. What happened in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina is a classic example. They bought a whole lot of brand new equipment that didn't work under the duress of a real situation, and as such you had, let me drop it. You had a bunch of law enforcement people in the field who lost complete communication back to their headquarters, and pretty soon they started saying, my life is at risk, I haven't gotten any communication back to my headquarters where I can call for backup, and eventually decided their life is more valuable than the service they're trying to provide, and in many cases they abandon their post, they abandon their town, and in some cases they abandon their state. They just walked away because the two-way radios in the hand, all it could be used for was a club. They couldn't charge it, they couldn't talk, and other than that, it was a great piece of electronics. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, great point, Dick. I never thought of that. That actual monitoring and recording can be done from anywhere on the normal. So in digital, we don't have that option. So when it goes down for them, the record is lost and no way to recover. Wow, that is an important structure in our communication system. Very good. Back to you, Dick.
And the business I'm in, I hear more and more of these horror stories of where various first responder organizations are being told that their VHF and UHF networks are obsolete, no longer going to be maintained, they're out of date, and they've got to be updated to these new 800 megacycle trunk systems, digital operations, whiz bang systems with all these extra horns and whistles. On paper, it sounds great. And the company selling those equipment manages to sell them a whole lot of brand new electronics at great price tags. But the higher frequency systems have much smaller range. The digital equipment characteristic has a much smaller range. The ability of other people to monitor it, it goes down the tubes. The number of failures it has where the digital equipment doesn't get the signal through, there's a huge amount of history of that. Of the people who have switched to the more modern, higher frequency, more digital equipment with these more capability, you study the track record of those who have made that decision. It is my belief that a high percentage of those people who made that change in the big picture turned out to be unhappy. They went out of the pan into the fire. It got worse. Before you abandon the system with all of your VHF, UHF repeaters that have got great range, and got great track record, they've got great reliability and whatever, and occasionally you get a little bit of, and the lower VHF frequencies, once in a while in May and June, you get a band opening and you start hearing some co-channel interference for a couple of hours. But except for a couple of disadvantages like that, you had reliability, you had a whole lot of well-established equipment that you knew how to maintain. And you switch over to this brand new stuff that has smaller range, smaller reliability, more methods of failure, lousy sounding audio that you think is now more secure, and you think that security is what you need. Wow.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The total number of naive decisions that are being made in that circumstance is just out of sight. An awful lot of the first responder organizations have got unreasonable arrogance. They believe they know what they're buying. They can't admit that they don't understand the technology. They can't admit that they don't know what they don't know. They're not smart enough to go out and hire a real consultant who understands the technology and can explain to them what they're really buying and what they're going to get for their money. a high percentage of those first responder organizations are afraid to admit they don't know, and they're afraid to hire some organization that has the knowledge that they need, some unbiased organization that can give them the objective answer as to whether or not they're really getting something that's better after they spend all these zillions of dollars. That happens over and over again. How can we keep going down that path? I can give you examples of what has happened in major metropolitan areas like New Orleans, like New York City, like Los Angeles, like Toronto, where they have, in many cases, run into some huge problems because they didn't understand what they're buying. And this happens over and over again, and people keep the secret, and each individual organization that runs into the problem tries to keep the light under the bushel basket. They're afraid to admit they made a big mistake, therefore it doesn't go public, therefore other people fall victim to the same problem. And we keep repeating that over and over again. There's got to be a better way. How do we get that message out? You guys that are in the sound of my voice are radio operators. You understand the way radio works, the way it propagates. You know something about the difference between analog modulation, whether it be amplitude or angular modulation, versus digital modulation. And the digital...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
On paper, the digital modulation has these great advantages. Oh, take a look what has just happened in the last few years of over-the-air television broadcasts. The good news is that on paper, your individual television channels that are 6 megacycles wide now contain 2, 3, or 4 channels of information. You do have more channels of information in the same number of megacycles. And the picture itself, when it's there, is snow-free. That's the good news. The bad news is the range is considerably smaller. The number of modes of failure is considerably higher. What used to be an extremely popular technique of over-the-air television broadcast has now become narrowcast. 90-some-odd percent of all the people in the metropolitan area watching television are watching it by way of some kind of a cable-like service. The number of people doing over-the-air broadcast television watching free of charge has gone to some very low number. I may be the only human being in the town of Huntington, 30 miles from New York City, that's watching over-the-air television broadcast because I'm willing to put an antenna on the tower to tie enough up. Without doing that, the digital television is giving the local residents, if they try doing it, very poor reception part of the time. Over-the-air television broadcast has almost ceased to exist when you're beyond, let me pick a number, 20 miles from New York City. There used to be people watching television 70 miles out. They now have a hell of a lot of trouble at 20 miles out and beyond. We have abandoned over-the-air broadcast television, per se, by flipping over to digital. Anybody got any further opinions on this whole thing? Have we really made an improvement? In some cases, yes. But boy, we gave up an awful lot in the process. KC2WGB, K2LX.
Repeater, timeout.
I watch over-the-air television up here, WI1PPH.
Okay, Hal, you're one of the very few people that's doing it. And you've got a nice high tower, and you're actually doing television DXing in that case. Is that true, Hal? WA1VVH, K2RIW?
Yeah, I just had to throw in that comment. It touched a nerve here, but yeah, I'm one of the few watching over the air. I've got a rotary TV antenna on a sidearm at about 80 feet, and yeah, I can watch TV in 4 states.
Hal, Harold, in your town of Pepperell, Massachusetts, what percentage of the population is watching over-the-air television in your town? Harold, what percentage of the population is watching over-the-air television broadcast in your town? WA1VVH, K2RIW?
It's a very good question. I suspect it's not many. However, I can tell you the cable service in this town is now because of the law. Besides me.
Okay, you dropped out when you told us something about the cable service, and you think there are very few people in your town watching over-the-air television broadcasts. When you drive up and down the individual streets of your town, do you see any operational television aerials on people's chimneys anymore? WA1VVH, K2RIW? Yeah, I think he's in the fade right now. Matt, KC2, I think it is, YDT, K2RW, go ahead, Matt.
Maybe others that I don't know about that are still watching over the air, go ahead.
Okay, I think you're saying there's very few. Did you say there's very few, Harold, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, looks like we're in a fade. Go ahead, Matt. KC2YDT, K2RIW.
N2RDB common.
N2 Mike Bravo common.
Okay, about the whole first responder thing going on. One thing that our system rescue team really prides itself on, having numerous amounts of hands on the team. We probably have a good 75% of the members of our team are ham radio operators. And not only do we have our public safety frequencies, but we have the ham frequencies as well. And we make a point whenever we're on a search or any operation like Katrina, et cetera, to have the ham radio side as well for that reason.
W2TTT with a quick one. W2TTP, recognized. Here we go. Matt, you're telling me that the first responders are making sure ham radio operators are present because you don't completely trust the reliability of their main first responder two-way radio equipment. Is that sort of what you're saying, Matt? Go ahead.
On our team, that's the case. I can't speak for the first responder community in general, but I know on our particular team, we have that. And that's one of the reasons why our team gets called out a lot is due to our communication.
Well, good, Matt. Well done, Matt. Tim and Barry, stand by a second because I think Gordon is only in a good position for a short period of time. Whiskey 2, Tango, 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 KQRW. Go ahead, Gordon.
Good evening, Dick. I really appreciate the break in here. Just driving home straight from Atlanta, I literally have been doing 888 miles continuously with two pauses for health breaks. But I was in Greensboro on Thursday and Friday, and I'm passing along greetings from Joe with the Alpha 2, Bravo Alpha Juliet, WA2BAJ. We used to be riding around on a bicycle mobile, if you remember, when he was up here. But he wanted to say hello to you and all the other guys, Howie and all the other guys in the gang. Over.
Thank you for the information, Gordon. Yeah, Joe used to put on lots of miles on his bicycles every day. He was a real bicycle enthusiast. Tim, I wonder if you've got exposure to first responder radio equipment and its real reliability now that more and more of it's becoming higher frequency, more digital, and all of these things that's supposed to be an improvement, and more narrowband and closer channels. I'm not convinced we're moving in the right direction. I think we're possibly moving in the wrong direction. N2RDB, K2RIW. You got it, Tim.
Yes. Well, two things, actually. Firstly, in answer to your query, I agree. Digitally trunked systems have a single point of failure. They all have a central computer. And if that gets knocked out, the whole system is useless. The radios can't talk unit to unit. So, see, that's where hams excel. 90% of what we do is tactical point-to-point, at least from the ARRI standpoint. It's tactical point-to-point simplex or possibly through a repeater.
And you brought up a very good point with that single point of failure with these digital-like systems. Wow. On top of that, many of the cell phone systems that are in use today are so heavily speech-processed and vocoded and whatever that the there are times when somebody leaves me a message on my work telephone and I have to call the person back saying, please repeat the message to me on a wired real telephone so I could tell you're talking to me I can tell you're trying to say something, but I'm not getting the message. And then the person will sometimes call me back on a wired telephone, but he's in the conference call network, and he's in a great big echo chamber somewhere. And again, you have great difficulty understanding what the hell he's saying. There are some of these circuits these days that you might not recognize the voice of your own mother because the voice is so heavily distorted. How in the world people are tolerating that, I don't know. I mean, there are circuits these days that are capable of transmitting some very nice, high-quality audio. And if you don't transmit high-quality audio, you're going to be losing the message in a lot of cases. But these networks that many first responders are being talked into, as I said before, on paper it sounds great. But how in the world are these people spending such huge amounts of money in such a naive manner where they don't hire somebody to objectively look at what is the real track record of that exact model number of equipment they're about to buy? How often has it been used? How happy are those customers? What kind of problems have they had? How come nobody asks those questions before spending $1 billion? And that scene keeps repeating over and over again. I bet you've heard some stories along these lines, Barry. N2 Moonbounce, K2RAW.
Further comment, N2RDB.
Yeah, Barry first, and then I'll come back to you, Tim. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, yeah, I got a couple of comments. First of all, as far as over-the-air TV goes, strangely enough, there is a bit of a resurgence of that recently. I've had a number of people call me in the last year that said that they don't care for the cable, they want to turn it off and just go to regular over-the-air TV for many reasons. That's the good news, if it's good news, I don't know, but that's the news. The other problem is getting them back on hasn't been all that easy. It appears that the digital TV is much more critical. You got to have a better signal, and it doesn't always work. So sometimes I just cannot get these people back on. That's for a couple of reasons. One of them, I think, is because the digital codes are so complex that this stuff breaks up. But the other reason is because everything's moved to UHF now. So stations that they were getting, they might have a little more trouble getting because they don't receive the UHF as well as they did the VHF. And as far as the communications area goes, I think one of the ventures into digital would be this Moto Turbo thing, which is here in New York. There's a repeater and a few more. I was on it briefly, I think for about a month, and I was able to compare it to a repeater right on the same building as I traveled upstate. They were both on 450, whatever, and I noticed that Moto Turbo was pretty close to the reliability, be able to receive a signal as the conventional analog repeater. However, it definitely faded out first, and I could go several more miles. When I got way upstate, and I would just get bits and pieces of the analog
repeater. Time out. Repeater. Time out. Cancel.
Barry, you timed out on the second half of what you were telling us about how bad the audio was with the Moto Turbo. You couldn't even recognize somebody. Please repeat that section. Repeat the second one-third, the last one-third of your message, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW.
Yeah, I was saying that repeaters, people that I knew their voices, I recognized them when they were on Moto Turbo. I couldn't even tell who they were. I mean, I could understand them, but their voice was so, it wasn't distorted, it was just so rebuilt, and there was so much missing, I couldn't recognize who the person was, except for the call letters. I mean, just awful. I'm not saying communications always has to be hi-fi, but that is seriously affecting how well you can understand what the person is saying. So that may just be a problem with Moto Turbo. There are other digital modes that don't appear to be that bad. Echolink is forever, it's digital, and it sounds great, but Echolink is not something that's being broadcast, so I don't know how it would hold up coming out of a repeater. And 2MB. Okay, so some of these digital techniques, by the way they break the speech up and reconstruct it, have got some terrible characteristics where you don't recognize the person who's doing the speaking. And I've heard cell phones that sound like that. Now maybe you've operated with more cell phones than I have, Barry. Maybe you've had a slightly better response, but some of the cell phone services that I've heard sound almost as bad as this Moto Turbo thing that you're describing. I wonder if you've experienced any of that. N2MB, K2LIW.
Yeah, like everybody else, I use cell phones every day. And they are restricted, but nowhere near as bad as Moto Turbo. Moto Turbo is in a class by itself. I don't recognize these people's voices. And also, as I say, when you get further away from the repeater and the signal starts to get weak, Moto Turbo doesn't do it. It drops out. You lose it. Conventional repeater, you don't lose it. I understand that Moto Turbo claims to be able to handle two or three or four channels on the same frequency. I don't know if hams need that, but that could be an advantage. I don't know.
Give me a couple more words here, Barry. The Moto Turbo system that you were investigating, was this something that was being installed where the intended user was a first responder in New York City? Over to you, Barry.
It's identical to that system. The Moto Turbo that I was involved with is a repeater. It's a ham repeater. I don't remember the call letters. Here in New York. And it's operating on 450. And so are a number of other repeaters on the same building. The antennas are only 15 feet apart. And the quality and the distance that I'm able to use on the conventional repeater is much, much better. However, I got to tell you, the Moto Turbo is it's the exact same system. The quality is going to be just the same for the first responders. It's the same equipment, just on a different frequency. That's all it is.
That's one hell of a testimonial by my standards. And by the way, the people that are coming to you because they want to go back to over-the-air television broadcast because for whatever reason they're not happy with the service, the reliability, the price, or whatever of cable-like television reception, part of the problem they're running into is, yes, now everything is UHF and very little of it is VHF anymore. That aggravates the problem. Second of all, digital television is very sensitive, like you said. It cannot tolerate very much inter-symbol distortion. Back in the days of analog television, if you're getting a direct signal from the Empire State Building and a slightly bounced signal from another building, that gave you a slightly delayed second signal, which gave you a ghost picture on the right-hand side. In other words, to the right of the real picture, you saw a ghost picture slightly displaced to the right. But at least it was watchable. In the case of the digital television, in many cases, it cannot tolerate the slight time shift of the second signal, unless that second signal is a large number of dB weaker than the first signal. It's now getting digital pulses from the strong signal, and in between the blank areas of the strong signal, it's getting the weak pulses from the secondary signal, and it can't, in many cases, tolerate that. And therefore, the whole thing breaks down, and it says weak signal. When you look at the signal strength indicator, let me drop. When you look at the signal strength indicator of a modern-day digital television reception circuit, you think it's really telling you signal strength. Uh-uh. The main thing it's telling you is bit error rate, because of inter-symbol distortion. The main signal it's getting could be 25 decibels above threshold, but because of the inter-symbol distortion, it is getting a bit error rate is such that it cannot any longer reconstruct that signal, and it reports it as a weak signal. The screen will write up weak signal. It doesn't mean the signal is weak. It means that the signal to noise rate, that means that the bit error rate was so high that it looked like a weak signal, but it's not necessarily a weak signal. As such, the people who are trying to reestablish television reception these days, even though you might have direct line of sight to Empire or World Trade or whatever,
even though you have direct line of sight, and in your case, Barry, you're only 10 or 15 or 20 miles away, and you should be getting great reception. Those people who used to be able to get good reception with a simple antenna now, in many cases, need a higher gain antenna with rotator. As such, they're going to discover that when they watch channel 4, they have to aim the rotator in this direction. When they watch channel 7, they have to aim the rotator in that direction. When they watch channel 11, what's called channel 11, these are really UHF channels, you have to aim the antenna in some other direction. You have to peak the antenna in a direction that makes the undesired second path signal just weak enough or just phase shifted enough that the converter can reconstruct that signal and say, yes, I understand that. So for reasons we never needed in a major metro area, we never needed a rotator before, we now need a rotator. I wonder if you've seen evidence of that, Barry. N2MB, K2LIW.
Yeah, and not only that, but you also need a very highly directional antenna for that very reason, because the multipathing coming in does screw up the signal, and sometimes a rotator will help, but sometimes your antenna is just, beam width is just too wide, and it just screws up everything. I've also seen another phenomenon where you'd be watching the TV, and it would just instantly switch to another channel. It's not doing that. It's picking up another signal that it was able to decode rather than the one you were looking at.
Give me a couple of words on that one. If I was watching channel 9-1, would it suddenly flip over to 9-2? Or if I was watching 9-1, it would suddenly flip over to 11? What was it doing there, Barry? Go ahead.
It appears that it would just, whatever is actually, in other words, if it was 9-1, if there was another 9-1 coming in and it couldn't make up its mind, periodically it would just switch to the other one. I don't think it was actually changing to 9-2 or anything like that. I think it was right on that spot, but it was not knowing which one to lock onto.
Interesting. I haven't experienced that yet. But I'm going to be putting a higher antenna with a rotator on my tower in order to do some more of this television DXing that the JoeW2RYY has been doing. Sounds like a fun thing. Tim, I know you wanted to add some more information here. N2RDB, go right ahead, K2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. This is N2RDB again, and I too ditched cable vision, got sick and tired of their shenanigans, and decided to switch over to on-air television, take the plunge, as it were. Well, anyway, I have a little cheap Yagi-type antenna I paid $20 for. It has a signal amplifier of sorts in it and a little cheesy rotator. It's sold as an indoor-outdoor antenna. I would not mount it on the roof. It wouldn't last but a week. However, on the landlord's deck, where I go in and out of my apartment, works just fine. Get all the major channels, no problem. As you say, I have to rotate the antenna back and forth for a given channel, but works perfectly. N2RDB.
Yeah, I got to ask him a question there, N2RDB. How many actual channels are you getting? I haven't counted them recently. I don't really care to watch them all. A lot of them are ethnic, silly stuff that I wouldn't understand, but a lot of, oh, I should get it. I get almost 30 channels. I mean, how many channels are you actually getting?
That's for you, Tim. Tim lives in Mineola, so how many real channels do you think you're getting off the air, Tim?
Real channels, in the sense of channels I can actually understand, 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11, 13, 21, there's the ION channels. I would have to say about 14 or 15 usable channels. And that's with something, a little cheap Yagi mounted about 9 feet off the ground under a deck.
Yeah, I just want to comment on that for a second. I don't know what frequency they are anymore because they change everything around. But I get something that's called channel 3. I also get a bunch of channel 12. I don't know, do you get those channels?
No 3, no 12, but good assortment of pretty much everything else. And a bunch of channels in Spanish, Chinese,